Hello, and welcome to Towards the Point, a cultural compass for Pompey and beyond. I'm James Sandy, and with my co-presenter Simon Mobbs, we'll try and give you a sharp slice of lemon in the G&T of life. Tonight, our theme is ebb and flow. We'll be exploring art, music, and possibly the death of disco. If that's not enough, there's also some events for you to go and find out about locally. We start tonight with art. Simon, tell us about the strange things that are going on at the Aspects.
Okay, at the Aspects Gallery, we've got an exhibition called 100 Seas Rising, which is by the artist Suki Chan, and is also a collaboration with the Portsmouth University School of Technologies. Basically, the exhibition links to the 200th anniversary of Charles Dickens's birth in Portsmouth and explores the theme of revolution.
And if folks go along and expect to see flashes of colour and paintings, they're going to be slightly disappointed.
No, none of that. This is an installation piece with the primary emphasis being on sound. What's happened is that Suki Chan has collaborated with the University School of Technologies from Portsmouth, in particular their recording centre and mobile recording studio. They've gone out and they've recorded local people talking about their ideas about revolution, about if they could change something about today's society, what it would be. These 2, 3, 4 minute snippets have then been introduced into the installation that you see in the exhibition.
And that's a key word, isn't it? Revolution, because as you mentioned, it's loosely based on A Tale of Two Cities and the Hundred Flowers movement in China. Mm. But the idea is that it's about kind of the role of culture and literature in revolution specifically, I think.
Yeah. I mean, something I got from it a lot was also about being about education. When you first go into the space in the Aspects Gallery, the Gallery One space, you've got 100 what look like school desks, quite old school desks. And on each individual desk, what you've got is a speaker. And from each speaker is a different person talking about their particular ideas about what needs to change in society, their own idea of what revolution would be. But because there's 100 of these desks all at the same time, what you get is a loud kind of babble, almost like you're in a canteen or something like that. There's nobody in the room, but it sounds like there's 100 people in the room.
Now, see, this is where it lost me slightly, because I'm open-minded, shall we say, and I'm keen to see new things. But I'm not sure sound art kind of works in this way. And that's obviously, I'm being quite critical here, but as you described it, there are 100 desks with 100 speakers. Mm. And obviously, somebody's trying to create a sound wave, so obviously it links to the 100 Seas Rising title. But for me, and I was talking to you about this earlier, for me, my problem with it is that I couldn't isolate individual voices.
Yeah.
Now, maybe that's partly the point. I came away from it thinking, actually, I can't understand that, because all I can hear is the noise. But is that partly the point? Is it partly that voice is noise rather than...
Maybe. I mean, they've got some interesting people here, haven't they, giving talks? I mean, you've got some local Portsmouth academics, you've got Tony Benn, you know, the old Labour MP, and, you know, you've got a lot of interesting comment being made, and there's a website you can go on and you can listen to some of these comments individually, and there's some pretty, you know, insightful stuff here. But when you're in the room, for a large part it's babble, isn't it, and you can't hear above the row. I found that if you put your ears close to some of the speakers, some were louder than others and you could hear them, and also if it's been engineered, it's been sound engineered in a way so it goes up and down in terms of volume. And there was in the 20 minutes 30 minutes I was there was a few moments where just one or two voices, everything else quieting down, you could hear just one or two voices. And in those instances, I could hear very clear points being made above the rabble.
I can almost picture you on your knees with your ear against one of the speakers, about to be ejected from the gallery. There is also a roaming desk, and this is quite an interesting idea. Now, the roaming desk hides out in the cafe area, which is where I hid after the exhibition to have a cup of tea and calm down a bit. But tell us a bit more about that, because the idea is that people can contribute, I think.
That's right. I mean, in the same way that this was created itself, it went out and found people. Anybody can contribute and kind of put their own ideas of a revolution, and I believe that's going to be then collated in a gallery on the Isle of Wight, and that's going to be presented in some format, probably not the same format. Going back to what you're saying about the actual kind of the impact of it, I felt that for me the audio aspect worked better. I felt like the swarming, fluctuating, kind of almost overwhelming sound of the chatter. It was so loud at some points, I felt my heartbeat quicken, you know. It was really quite something. And I like the ebbs and flows, and I like the points where it all quiet down, and you could just hear one voice above the others, and maybe you could read symbolism into that.
You used the word babbling earlier on, which, you know, on this programme we're more than entitled to use, I think, but it is that kind of babbling brook idea of using lots of different voices as almost instruments. But I found, I'm not sure this was intentional, but I found something very interesting. When the time I spent in the space, I could hear the relays clicking in each of the desks. So I could hear the sounds being activated. Now, I thought, is that just cheap wiring? And then I thought, well, actually, is it something about automation and about, you know, the triggers to particular things? And is it actually part of, you know, maybe I was reading far too much into it, but is it something about, you know, industrialization and automation and those kind of things as well?
Maybe, so, maybe. I mean, I found that the visual aesthetics of it weren't quite as strong. I felt that there's quite a few loose cables and things like that around. And I guess the approach that she was going for was like, you know, let the bare bones of the piece be shown. You know, it's about the sound. If there's some wires, if there's some clicks and things like that, it's kind of like surplus. And
it's a kind of immersive experience, isn't it?
Yeah.
In terms of the legacy of the project, you mentioned that it might be going into the Isle of Wight and further. I wondered more generally, kind of sound art, if we call it that. Yeah. I mean, I wonder how that can be captured in time and sort of, you know, seen by future generations, because this is a very kind of, I guess, a kind of temporary exhibition in some ways, isn't it?
I've heard some interesting sound art before. There's in particular a piece at the Whitechapel Gallery in East London, and that was made 10 years ago. And what it does is it takes you on a tour around the local area and around the actual gallery space. I went back to it, and what's quite interesting, the gallery's changed now. So you go on a tour around the gallery and the building's changed and it's not the same as it used to be. And then you go out into the streets of Brick Lane and so on, and some of Brick Lane's changed as well. But yeah, maybe sound art can live on.
For me, the concept, the idea, and my experience of the exhibition, I kind of came out of it feeling like I'd had a very bad dream. I did find it slightly harassing, I have to say. Mm. You know, it made me feel slightly uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Not because of the content, but because I couldn't make sense of it.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I couldn't get a handle on the voices or the noise. I could totally get the sense of the sound wave, you know, the kind of volume moving from one end of the room to the other, and that kind of worked, and the kind of whoosh. But I would have liked to have heard, and maybe I need to check the website out for this, but I would have liked to have heard some of those individual voices more strongly.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And also, I do wonder whether Suki Chan is kind of pro kind of revolution, or is she anti-revolution, or is she indifferent? I mean, it's inspired by the French revolutionary mob in The Tale of Two Cities. And my understanding about this book is that the upper classes, the bourgeois classes, are kind of suppressing the peasants and the working classes. And initially, Charles Dickens shows a lot of sympathy for the working classes and the peasants. But then when all their voices do get heard and they start to rise above and kind of rebel against the bourgeois, he doesn't seem to have much sympathy for them either. So it's quite a kind of indifferent book in that sense. It kind of gives both sides of the argument. Also, in Dickens' early life, his dad was thrown into debtors' prison. He had to be taken out of school and work in a factory at a very young age. So again, maybe this link with the school desks, and the fact I found that quite a lot of people were talking about education, although they could talk about revolution and what they would change about society, a lot of them seem to go to school and education being the root. So I think there's quite a few links here to the book and to Dickens' life.
We used the word babble earlier on, but I'd like to also introduce the word rabble, because there is an idea, I think, that this exhibition is linked to, let's call it, the summer of rioting that occurred in certain parts of the country. And do you think they've tried to tap into that quite newsworthy headline, kind of, let's go out and start a small revolution kind of idea? Do you think there's a sense of that?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, like, it's kind of like, it's so loud. So many voices are kind of like giving their opinions and showing their kind of strong, passionate feelings about what they want changed about society, that it becomes overwhelming, doesn't it? It literally, the sound is overwhelming at points in the room. I think what's also interesting is that it's inspired by the 100 Flowers movement in 1950s China. I wasn't really aware of this very much. I've done just a little bit of reading about it. And my understanding is that people are invited to kind of give a variety of viewpoints, basically to kind of let them openly express their opinions. When I first heard that thing about, oh, let 100 flowers bloom, let 100 schools of thought content, I thought, that's a very positive quote. I like the sound of that. She's obviously pro-revolution. When I read into the background of it, it's maybe a slightly more cynical kind of take on what revolution and what freedom of speech does.
100 Seas Rising, an exhibition at the Aspects Gallery in Gunwharf Quays, is on until the 2nd of September. Admission is free. We turn now to music and an album that's been re-released, Diamond Mine, by John Hopkins and King Creosote. I think I got that right, didn't I, Simon?
Yeah, you did indeed.
Excellent. So tell us a bit more about this, because this is something you threw at me as a bit of a wild card, and
I was intrigued. It's been a bit of a sleeper hit. It's gathered more and more attention from when it was released last year. I think a reflection of that is that it's been re-released with extra material on it as well.
And it's a kind of bumper jubilee edition. Is that the idea? A marketer's dream?
Yeah. I mean, it's a short album initially, and then they've added like another kind of 20 minutes onto it. So it actually feels more like a normal length for an album. But yeah, I think it's a fantastic album.
So tell us a bit more about King Caruso and John Hopkins, because I've heard the names and I don't know a great deal about the two artists.
It's not a surprise. I mean, King Caruso is a very DIY kind of artist. He releases stuff on his own label. He has been doing so for a while now. I think he's got actually 40 albums released.
Wow. Is that what we would call lo-fi?
definitely lo-fi. So definitely fits into the independent, you know, with a capital I, singer-songwriter bracket. His work is often quite kind of poignant in terms of the lyrics. He deals with like autobiographical themes. It's very honest. It's not your average kind of top 10 sort of song. It's quite can be uncomfortable to listen to.
It's sometimes. Not a top pop tune.
No. And he's from Fife in Scotland. And then John Hopkins, on the other hand, is from London, and his genre of music is more electronic, ambient, dance music, that kind of thing. He's done quite a lot of collaborations. He's worked with people like David Holmes and Brian Eno. He's done soundtracks to films such as the recent film Monsters. And on his own albums, he's explored electronic, ambient, house, even dubstep, that kind of stuff. He's supported and toured with bands like the XX, Royksopp, Fortet, that kind of thing. One of the ways his music's been described is that although he deals with electronic music, he's classically trained, and he brings this kind of knowledge of being, you know, kind of able to play a piano properly and compose a piece of music properly to his electronic pieces. And a BBC journalist described his work as epic, soaring and emotional.
Now, this album originally came out, I think, in March of last year.
Right,
and reissue has a number of other tracks that didn't quite make it onto the seven of the original.
Yeah.
And unbelievably, we're told that those seven tracks took around about 7 years to record.
Well, I'd contend that. I think that sounds very good on like the kind of press release that they released. But I think what happened was that King Caruso wrote these tracks and put them down on paper, put them down for a while. And then when he did this collaboration with John Hopkins, they seemed appropriate for the theme they were aiming for. And the kind of thing that they're going for in this album is the kind of fictional lives of villages in this, you know, small kind of part of Fife. Most of them work at sea or involve people who work at sea. And it's trying to create this gentle village life mood, but also, I think, the kind of the serenity and the greatness of living by the sea.
Now, it's inspired by, and I'm going to try and pronounce this, the East Nake of Fife. Now, if anyone out there can tell me how to pronounce that properly, then email the show. But as you said, it's inspired by a kind of rural, coastal, kind of fishing village kind of life.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. That's the kind of sound that they're trying to get across to us. The reissue just kind of collects a number of extra bits that didn't make it into the album. Is that the way it goes usually?
Yeah. And I think, you know, the original album was short but sweet. You know, it was about half an hour long, and there was a lot of electronic elements in there. Like, you'd sometimes have, like, the introductory track is 2-3 minutes long. And it's basically ambient sounds of the Scottish villages with some piano and some orchestration and no lyrics.
Mm.
And then you go into an acoustic guitar on the second track, and eventually a minute or two into that, he actually starts singing. So there's a lot of kind of, I wouldn't call it padding. I think it works very well, but there's a lot of kind of stuff around the lyrics which helps them resonate and helps the music resonate.
Yeah, I think it's a great album, and it's also an album that when I sat down and listened to it in its entirety, I'd realised that I'd heard lots of across radio in terms of in session, and a lot of it was very familiar to me, which I was surprised by, because it's not an album that instantly I think, oh yeah, I know what that is, you know, I know what's on there. Now, also in reading around for the show, I found a very interesting term which attempts to categorise what's captured on this album. And because this is an arts and culture review programme, we're allowed to use what I would call flowery language. Okay, we're allowed to be verbose, I think. Now, there's a term, musique concrète. Okay, if there's anyone French listening, I apologise. That broadly means concrete music. And it describes itself as a form of electroacoustic music that utilises acousmatic sound as a compositional resource. Now, I'm not really clear what that means, but I think what it's trying to get at is noise as an instrument, which actually links to some of the things we were talking about 100 Seas Rising. So there's an interesting kind of dynamic to this. It's not just folksy, rural kind of snapshot. It's actually trying to kind of transcend some of the work that the two artists have done independently,
oh,
I think.
Oh, yeah, and I think it works beautifully. I mean, you've got, he's got a fantastic voice, I think that has to be said. It's, you know, very soft and very clear. Then you've got, you know, very, you know, nice folk vocals. You've got some choirs in there, some female backing vocals. And then you've also got this mix with electronic, glitchy beats, cinematic, I'd say, kind of minimal ambient sonics, which, as I say, kind of, I feel like let the out of the songs resonate. It reminded me a little bit of the later work of Radiohead, the more recent work of Radiohead, which...
The more indulgent Radiohead.
Yeah. And it's got that kind of bit of guitar. It's got that, you know, Tom York, Old Horse, I think, has got a very nice voice. But it does mix it with that slight dance influence, but in a subtle, mellow kind of way.
Now, I think comparators are really interesting because, you know, often when you find a new band or a new artist, people say, oh, what does it sound like? Now, this is a tough one. This is a tough call because it doesn't actually sound too much like other things. But there are two or three things in my brain, at least, it reminded me of. One is a fantastic album, which you haven't had a chance to listen to. Go out and... borrow, steal, lend a copy, whatever you can. It's an artist called Emiliana Torini, an album called Fisherwoman's Blues, and it's a great album, and she uses acoustic recordings and very sort of, I suppose, ambient sound to get across the trials and tribulations of a particular demographic, if you like, of a particular community. So that's one thing it reminded me of. There's also an album which was made a few years ago called Out of Season by Beth Gibbons of Portishead and a guy called Rustin Mann. I'm not sure that's his real name, but Rustin Mann from Talk Talk. And in fact, Talk Talk, another kind of reference point, I think, potentially for this.
Yeah.
And last but not least, if that swirl of things isn't enough for you, there's a guy called Ivor Cutler. Now, arts and culture buffs out there will go, oh, yeah, we know Ivor Cutler. He's an acquired taste, but more a kind of poet and a kind of a kind of spoken word narrative artist, really. But there are elements of him, I think, in this. Now, whether that's knowing or not, I don't know, but that's certainly what kind of my first impression.
I can definitely see all of that in there, for sure. And but I think, like you say, what's interesting is that it is quite hard to define as well. I've got a quote here from King Creosote when he first made this album, which is, it feels like the beginning of something, and it feels that so far down the line after putting out 40 effing albums, oh my god.
Yeah, 40's a lot, isn't it, I think. There's a new Neil Young album coming out soon, I think, which is his 35th album. So 40, there you go.
Even
more than that. So obviously they've got a lot of recognition out of this track. They've got you know, quite rightly recognised for a great piece of work, but I guess that wasn't their intention. Their intention was to do something experimental and different and interesting.
Yeah.
Now, I think it was nominated as well for a Mercury last year, I think.
Yeah, it was. And a lot of people, when they've... I read a review, for example, about the Diamond Mind Jubilee edition of the album, and they suggested that if the album had been more like a proper length, it had like, you know, more closer to an hour as opposed to the half hour it is in its original form, it might have been a good contender against PJ Harvey's album. I take that with a pinch of salt, because for me, the extra tracks on the album work great in isolation as an EP, which a lot of them were on, but bulk together as a whole, I don't think it quite works personally.
I agree with that, and also I think we have to add to that the idea that you'd have to go some to beat Let England Shake by PJ Harvey. So another track, if you haven't heard that album, go out and get that. Let's talk about some of the tracks that are on Diamond Mind, because there's one in particular I think you wanted to talk about, which is called Bats in the Attic.
Brackets
Unraveled, I think that's the full title.
Well, what you've got is Bats in the Attic is the original, and then on the extra material you've got a kind of extended version of it, which I think isn't totally necessary. But the actual original of it is, I think, really, really great song. It's what attracted me to buy the album. When I first heard it, it's got this kind of very soft lullaby kind of quality, and I thought, oh, this is a very touching song, and it kind of lures you in. And then when you actually listen to the lyrics, they're really quite something, you know, they really get to your gut. And it's about... For as far as I could see, it's about somebody, maybe a fictional character, who is looking back on their life. They're near retirement or in retirement, and they've got regrets, and they're not sure that they've lived up to their expectations that they had of themselves. And the bats in the attic is almost like an analogy for like having lived a still life. You know, the stuff's been stored away in the attic. They haven't moved much. They've accumulated all this material stuff. And gosh, yeah, I mean, I read a few comments online, people reviewing it, and grown men saying, yeah, I shed a tear or two to this after a glass of wine, and I can see it. It's a contender for a very, very moving track.
Now, I also watched the video, which you can watch on YouTube, and I think this was a video for the Unraveled version. So this was a second video that they created. Now, a really strange mix of things.
Was this the one with the bicycle riding on its own?
That's it, yeah, and a kind of... How you achieve this, I don't know. Some kind of ghosting kind of effect where you've got lots of kind of spiritual things moving in and out. And really kind of for a three and a half minute video, really quite sort of gripping, quite intense imagery.
Yeah.
But it worked. I mean, I enjoyed it. I mean, and that particular track, I can see why people focused on that and picked that out as a track. And as you say, the lyrics to that track... really heartfelt. You know, somebody's sat down and really thought about that. It's not just what can we make that's catchy and we can sell a few singles on the back of. It's a really kind of affecting song, I think.
Definitely. And you mentioned about this theme of old age, and the last track on the album, Your Young Voice, is just a repetition of a few lines about somebody, almost like an ode to their child. And it's like, you know, your young voice is the only thing that's keeping me going. And that's what kind of fades the album out. So as well as this kind of seafaring themes, which I think are beautifully realised in other parts, there seems to be this underlying theme as well of age and regrets and kind of, you know, things you have to deal with when you get to later stages of life.
The Jubilee edition of Diamond Mine by King Creosote and John Hopkins is now available on Domino Records. You can catch them in the act live at Camp Bestival from the 26th to 29th of July. They're also playing the Green Man Festival from the 17th. To the 19th of August. If you want to check out the YouTube video that we mentioned, you can check out our blog at towardsthepoint.blogspot.com. And now, poetry.
Borderland. Sitting out on the borderland, I'm a pebble on the shore. I'm a night without a whisper. I'm a room without a door. But the stars are in my pocket and the moon is in my head. I'm a book of many poems that's afraid of being read. I'm waiting for the gypsy to read the lines in my hand. I'm waiting for the changing tide to carry me from this strand. But the stars will always wander as the gypsies lose their way. So I sit out on the borderland, watching pebbles drift away.
Our thanks to Maggie Sawkins for that contribution. We move now to disco, or more specifically, the potential death of disco, in the shape of the passing of La Donna Adrienne Gaines, better known as Donna Summer. We've also recently had... Robin Gibb passed away, sadly, and there's a number of people sort of said, does this mean disco is fading out? Simon, what do you think about this?
I don't think that necessarily just because the people from that genre who started it are starting to pass away necessarily means that the influence stops to be continuing through in contemporary music, no.
We were saying earlier, I think, that, you know, the death of Elvis didn't necessarily mean the death of rock and roll.
No, and it might be like, you know, purist sort of version of rock and roll might have finished, but the kind of spirit and the kind of atmosphere of rock and roll continues through in a lot of other stuff still now, I think.
So going back to Donna Summer, she's famous, I think, for a particular track, and that track had a particular influence on music, late 70s onwards, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I Feel Love from 1977, you could argue, changed the face of electronic music from then right up until now. There's a whole wealth of acts that wouldn't sound like they sound, might not even existed in that format they are, without that track. It is highly, highly significant. I mean, it's worth maybe just talking a little bit about how that track came about. I mean, Donna Summer had, for example, been a part of a psychedelic rock band in the 70s. She'd done tours with a version of a Hair musical, things like that.
Well, we've all done that musical, haven't we, I think, in the past?
And she wrote a track called Love to Love Your Baby in 75. The Italian producer Giorgio Moroder, who encouraged her to sing it as well as just write it. Mm. And she was quite reluctant initially, and it actually worked, and it was a huge hit. And then that led her on to trying to do more tracks with him, and I Feel Love was one of them. What's interesting about this is that before then, all disco tracks had been an acoustic, orchestral kind of thing. Like, if you think about things like Kung Fu Fighting, KC and the Sunshine Band, ELO, these kind of bands... Yeah. It's proper, you know, old school instruments, orchestration, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's almost like a little bit kitsch. What this was, the first track that had electronic instruments and a proper kind of singing vocal on the top.
So was this, what you're saying then, is was this perhaps the first serious attempt at a genuine discotheque sound? And was it also maybe the first record that was taken seriously?
Yeah, yeah. And I think it fused together like a kind of experimental approach to making music. I mean, up until that point, probably the biggest electronic act was, say, Kraftwerk. And their sound is particularly a lot more vocodery, and it's definitely a lot more, like, you know, it's a lot more mechanical sounding. This one had electronic instruments, you know, synthesizers, drum machines, and then this kind of languid vocals on the top. And, you know, okay, it's disco, but I think more importantly, what it is it's the first major electronic song with vocals on it.
And the production of the record is interesting. You mentioned the 17-minute length on the album version of the track. I think we're hopefully right in saying that that was one of the first 12-inch records produced for clubs.
Yeah, I think the one you referred to, Love to Love You Baby, yeah, that's that, I believe that's right, yeah. And also what's interesting about the concept album that I Feel Love came from is that it kind of panned through decades. So the title track, I Remember Yesterday, is meant to be a kind of 1940s feel. Then there's a 50s track, 60s track. And the last track, I Feel Love, is meant to be the future. And that's the kind of the mindset it was created in. And a lot of people responded to this. For example, Brian Eno said to David Bowie when first hearing it, I've heard the sound of the future. This single is going to change the sound of club music for the next 15 years. And he was pretty much right. You know, from that disco kind of scene, which then started to go more electronic in the sound, you've got club music, which then turned into Detroit techno, Chicago house. Then it moved over to the UK, the rave scene, Manchester, all of that kind of stuff, and it exploded in the 90s. And then also, as well as dance music, you know, you've got acts like Gary Numan, Human League, Pet Shop Boys, New Order, all of these kind of people that have singing on top of electronic kind of instruments. All of that might not have happened in quite the same way if it hadn't been for this track.
Also, I think Donna Summer and the later part of her life became a kind of controversial figure, didn't she? Because some of the things that she kind of represented or promoted in terms of the disco scene, and in particular the gay scene, she kind of got in trouble with, she got into hot water with.
Well, yeah, I mean, she became very popular, and she's like the queen of disco, and she kind of got, you know, she, along with the Bee Gees and their soundtrack for Saturday Night Fever, they were the two kind of things that resurged disco in the late 70s and early 80s, as well as kind of disco fans generally, like the gay scene particularly kind of took her on as a bit of an icon. But then in the 80s, she made some comments about AIDS, for example, that it was a punishment from God for the immoral lifestyles that gay people were living. Mm. Now, that clearly upset a lot of people. And pretty soon after, a few years later, she backtracked on that and said it was a terrible misunderstanding, and she wished, you know, it had been misquoted and that kind of thing.
As her record sales plummeted, no doubt.
Yeah, yeah. And I believe in 1995 there was a lawsuit which ended up being settled out of court with New York Magazine. And it never really kind of got established whether she did say this or she didn't or what, but it clearly upset a lot of people, and it put her off, cut her off from the fan base, which she had, you know, evolved over a number of years.
Donna Summer, who sadly passed away in the middle of May. Just before we go, a quick roundup of some local events.
If you're interested in the 100 Seas Rising exhibition that we were talking about earlier on in the show, Suki Chan, the artist responsible, is going to be giving a talk interview about the piece at the Aspects Gallery. That's going to take place the 15th of June from 6 to 8pm.
What's next for culture in Portsmouth, you may ask? A conference exploring these opportunities is taking place on Friday, 29th of June, from 1:30 till 5:30 at the New Theatre Royal on Guildhall Walk. Keynote speakers include Ian Sinclair and Claire Doherty.
If you like film and you're a fan of existential comedies, you might be interested to see there's a couple of things about Woody Allen at the Number 6 Cinema. We have Woody Allen, a documentary, on Thursday the 21st of June, and we also have one of his recent films, Midnight in Paris, on Thursday the 28th of June. As I say, both at the Number 6 Cinema in Old Portsmouth.
And last but by no means least, Dundee act The View will be playing at the Wedgwood Rooms in Portsmouth on the 25th of June. That's it for this show. Thanks to Simon Mobbs. I'm James Sandy, and we'll be back again with you soon. Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.